This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Seaweed farming is actually good for the environment. Seaweed farms sequester a considerable amount of carbon because it can be absorbed. It is a natural filter, and it has been proven to reduce a significant amount of ocean acidification.
A wide array of economic analysts are increasingly recognizing the link between economic development and gender equality. Research is showing that when women succeed, developing economies thrive. But what impact, if any, does the increased economic role of women in the Global South have in terms of the environment? Today on Sea Change Radio, we feature two stories of women in Asia who are leading the way both economically and sustainably. First, I talked to Jenny Fernan, the president of Pangea Green Energy, a landfill gas company based in the Philippines. She tells us about this pioneering company which runs a biogas plant converting hazardous garbage into electricity. Then we hear from Shilpi Chotre, a consultant with Future 500, who discusses the burgeoning seaweed industry in India and the important role that women are playing in making it a success. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Jenny Fernan. She is the president of Pangea Green Energy in the Philippines. Jenny, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Yes, thanks for having me.
First, why don't you tell us what the mission of your company is, a little bit of a snapshot.
Okay, the mission of the company is really to produce green energy and to, at the same time, mitigate greenhouse gas emissions from landfill waste. So we have a small company. There are 17 people. We have three engineers who run a plant that operates with three electric engines. And the rest are field people who go and inspect the wells from the landfill.
Can you tell our listeners about the biogas project that your company operates in Quezon City in the Philippines?
Well, first of all, Quezon City, if you're familiar with Metro Manila, is the biggest city in Metro Manila. In fact, pretty much in the Philippines in terms of population size and square area. So needless to say, it generates a lot of garbage. There's about 1,200 tons of garbage coming from households in Quezon City and being disposed at this disposal facility. And from there, that's where we get the gas from the garbage. And that gas, you know, when garbage decomposes, it produces gas. And 50% of that gas is methane. And methane is a greenhouse gas. And at the same time, methane can be used to power electric engines, so you can produce clean energy from it.
Can you break it down for us a little bit more on how technically converting garbage into energy works?
Okay, you start with, of course, a mound of trash, which is pretty much, you know, designed so that you cover the garbage, and then the garbage is compressed, it's covered by soil, and it's layers and layers of garbage and soil, garbage and soil. Once an area of the landfill or disposal facility is completed, it's compressed, and then we come in and drill wells on this on the surface. The wells are about 35 meters deep, 15 to 30 meters deep, and from those wells we extract the gas by negative pressure. The gas is piped into our plant, and our plant gets the gas, filters it from the condensate, and then when it's dry, it feeds into electric engines. And these electric engines produce electricity.
And how much electricity is this project, this biogas facility in Quezon City, producing right now?
At the moment, we are producing about 840 kilowatts of electricity. We utilize the plant because we need some of that power. We use about 100 kilowatts. The rest is exported to the grid and sold to the public utility.
So can you give us an idea of what that means in terms of per household, 840 kilowatts, Jenny?
840 kilowatts is enough to power about, I would say, 2,000 households. You know, there's no way for us to sell directly to the consumers, so we have to sell to the power utility.
Can you give us an idea of the range of biogas facilities like yours around the world and where you got the inspiration for this?
The technology comes from Europe. They've been doing this kind of technology for the past 30 years. So it's an established technology. It's tried and tested. And we got the idea because there was the Kyoto Protocol, where the industrialized countries signed a pact saying they will reduce their emissions by 5% by the year 2012. Of course, the U.S. didn't sign. And then I have partners in Italy who have been trying to find projects in the Philippines. And this particular project, they were very interested in. So I decided, okay, why not? I talked to the Quezon City government, and we actually were a small company competing against big companies, but we were able to get the project. They were able to give it to us because we did everything ourselves. So under the Kyoto, an industrialized country can invest in a developing country and be able to offset their commitment to reduce their emissions. So that falls under the Kyoto is actually under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And under this UNFCCC, there is what they call the Clean Development Mechanism, whereby an industrialized country can invest in a developing country and be able to offset their commitment against that. So this is what happened. The Philippines being a developing country, and it's since it was able to, through this project, it's able to destroy a greenhouse gas, you know, methane being a greenhouse gas. We produce what they call carbon credits under the United Nations. It's called carbon emission reduction. It's equivalent to one carbon emission reduction, or one CER, is equal to one CO2 ton. You're able, if you calculate that methane is 21 times more toxic than the carbon dioxide, you're able to, you know, produce a lot of CO2 tons in the process. But for, you know, when you destroy one ton of methane, you're actually destroying 21 tons of CO2 equivalent.
Can you give us an idea of some of the largest biogas projects around the globe, Jenny?
I know that in Italy, the one that our we have an Italian consultant who is also our technical consultant. He used to run a 10 megawatt facility in Turin in the northern part of Italy, and I don't know of anything that's more than maybe 20 megawatts. Yes, it do. Yes, it do. Oh, yeah. If you only believe when you're down, when you're on the street, when evening falls so high.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the president of Pangea Green Energy, Jenny Fernan. So you're hoping to get over a megawatt with this pretty soon.
Right, because I think, you know, we're learning as we go along. And I think that there is a factor that where, you know, there are economies of scale, of course. But, and yet, you can't go beyond, you can't be over-optimistic about it because you don't know how much gas you can get. And, you know, it's finite. Once the landfill is closed, you probably will only start to get, the gas flow will gradually decline. It peaks at a certain point and then it will decline because of the decomposition of garbage. It's the nature of the garbage, yeah.
And what kind of garbage lends itself best to optimum gas production?
This is municipal solid waste. So it's household garbage. It's not industrial. It's not hospital waste.
It's not sewage and human waste.
It's not sewage. It's not human waste. No. This is municipal solid waste.
So I'd like to move past the technology now and talk a little bit more about being a woman and being a president of a Philippine-based energy company. How did you get started, and what are some of the challenges that you face?
We were the first, actually, to do this in the Philippines. There are two other companies that did it, that started around the time we did. But I would think we have been the most successful because we were also the most conservative. So we started small and we're growing from there. They started big and they find that, you know, there's not enough gas, and so their investment is lost, right? As a woman, it was not easy to convince the project, the government, the local government, to do the project, also because, not just as a woman, but also because it was new in the country. And so they didn't trust that we would be able to do it. And of course, learning the technologies, it was a steep learning curve for me because I'm not an engineer. I'm a business person. I understood the business side of it, but slowly I've been able to understand the technical side of it, and that's it. You know, we were able to do it, and then the technology itself is very simple.
You mentioned how Quezon City is one of the largest, if not the largest, city within the greater metropolitan Manila area. Can you give us an idea beyond the environmental benefits, what kind of socioeconomic benefits your project has provided to the region?
Okay, yes. The project has a lot of socioeconomic benefits. In fact, the social benefit is probably the biggest, social and environmental benefits are the biggest contribution of this project, because the scavengers who live in around the garbage site actually are exposed to the health risks of, you know, breathing methane and breathing all these toxic gases. And this project has helped a lot, you know, extracting the gas has helped a lot in terms of that. And also, it has helped with stabilizing the dump site, because this area, it's not a real landfill. It is a mountain of trash. In the year 2000, there was an accident. There was a trash slide, and it killed a lot of people who live around the periphery of the garbage site. And all of these people depend on scavenging for their livelihood. So about 200 people died and all that. So this contribution by giving the garbage stability, the dump site stability, has really improved, the living conditions in the area. And then, of course, we employ some of the people there. So some of our employees are actually former scavengers. So that's helped a lot, too. And then we are helping the public school. This is an urban poor community, and there's a public school that's located at the foot of the dump site where we are supporting some scholars at that school. And actually, we also support, some of the needs of that school, in a sense. And that's where actually we did that exhibit in San Francisco of photos. These photos were taken by the children who are students of the school, and we're trying to promote these pictures and raise money so that we can provide them for our educational programs.
She's the president of Pangea Green Energy, Jenny Fernan. Jenny, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Shilpi Chotre. She is a marine and supply chain consultant at Future 500, which is a global nonprofit specializing in stakeholder engagement. Shilpi, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. Pleased to be here.
You penned a piece that was published in Yes Magazine this spring about the Indian seaweed harvesting industry and how the role of women in the seaweed industry in India. Can you first give us a little overview of, a lot of people may not know anything about the seaweed industry at all.
Absolutely. So to give you some background, the seaweed extract industry is projected to grow to $7 billion by 2018. So there's some growing concern with the stakeholders we've spoken with around the environmental and social issues that might come into play with seaweed farming. I started off the beginning of the year in India looking at what the Indian seaweed industry has done to sort of safeguard socioeconomic elements and also the environment.
How is the seaweed that we get in a sushi roll,
sure,
how does that come to us?
So the seaweed that we see in sushi and various food is actually a small portion compared to the global demand that we're seeing for seaweed. The seaweed extract business is actually the real driver of the industry. So seaweed extracts are also known as alginates, agar, and carrageenan. And these are thickening or emulsifying agents found in a wide variety of food and household products. So you might find carrageenan in your fruit jelly, in your soy milk, in your toothpaste. And this is a derivative of a red seaweed called Capophycus alvarezi, and it's found flourishing off the southern coast of India in the states of Tamil Nadu and also Kerala.
And when you say it flourishes, it flourishes naturally, but man and women ease it along. Why don't you explain how that process works?
Sure, absolutely. So seaweed farming in India is actually pretty small compared to the global production. But I was interested in seeing how they were dealing with social elements and also environmental elements, because they've been pretty successful in garnering a fair amount of seaweed produce and also keeping the environment intact and also providing a huge source of income for women. So this started back in 2000 because Pepsi-Cola was interested in carrageenan. So they set up a carrageenan processing plant and worked with several hundred self-help groups. So self-help groups are identified by NGOs and also the government in India to help those of lower income, poverty-stricken areas, many villages that don't have access to traditional jobs. A lot of times we're seeing in the fishing villages, because of climate change, over-harvesting and destructive fishing practices, that they no longer have a way for livelihood. So they've now turned to seaweed farming. So PepsiCo was really interested in A, producing carrageenan, but B, also providing income-earning capacities for poor rural areas. So they worked with the self-help groups, and what emerged was 75% of the workforce became women.
How did that happen? Was that happenstance or was it intentional?
Self-help groups are predominantly women, And because this is the first time they were earning income and seaweed farming had low barriers to entry, it was kind of a natural fit. Seaweed farming also provides flexible hours for women. So they can start with their children in the beginning of the day and then go work for several hours and then be home in time for household duties and taking care of their kids. So a lot of community leaders emerged from the women groups, and they sort of had this trickle-down effect where they were doing the training and they recruited more and more women to be part of the trade. So 2008, PepsiCo was ready to retire from the carrageenan production side of things, but really wanted to keep the income-earning capacity going for poor rural women. So they transferred the business over to one of their former employees, Abhiram Seth, and I had a really interesting discussion with him about the current company he created and how it's been really successful in recruiting and retaining women. The company is called Aqua Agri. And they have basically kept the contract farming model that PepsiCo had in 2000. They keep on recruiting women for the majority and set up different training stations in various parts of southern India to keep the movement going.
And your research has led you to think that this is a generally positive development for the women's movement in this region of southern India?
Yes, absolutely. So with the contract farming model, the women are not dealing with any middlemen, which has historically been part of a lot of corruption and derailment of actually getting the money to their pockets. So what happens is the women work in groups of about 4 to 6, and they do 95% of the work on land. So for them, it's not a safety or health issue as in a lot of other parts of seaweed farming and all over the world. They are able to work in flexible hours, like I said.
What about pay? What were they making before this program was instituted, and maybe how does it compare to what their male counterparts in the region earn?
So in India, the typical way to farm seaweed is with a bamboo raft. And the bamboo raft method requires very little time in the water. And so women are spending about 95% of time on land preparing the materials. And the way contract farming works is they determine the price for the season at the beginning of the season. So the market doesn't determine the price. There's back and forth between the company and the woman as to what a fair price would be. Now, once the bamboo raft is harvested, the entire raft is equal to more than a fisherman's daily pay. So they're getting about 33 rupees per kilogram of dried seaweed, which ends up being about 600 rupees daily. Now, an industrial worker, to put this into context, only makes about 300 rupees a day.
And what were they earning before? Were these women unemployed, or have they transferred specialties?
So I actually met with some of the women that are immersed in seaweed farming, and the majority, this is their first paid income they've ever had, which is quite astonishing. Another point to consider is that women are more likely to save the income they've earned and keep it within the household rather than spend it on other sources than their male counterparts.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Shilpi Chotre. She is a marine and supply chain consultant at Future 500. So Shilpi, the seaweed line method that we're talking about, that's not the universal method for growing seaweed around the world. Is that correct?
That's correct. In India, typically because we're working with seaweeds in shallow water, they use, it's called the bamboo raft method. And what they do is they put four pieces of bamboo together to make a square. And with this method, the beauty of it is that 95% of the work is actually done on land. So you see women, about 4 to 6 women in a group, sitting in a circle, tying small young seaweed plants in loops to form a string of seaweed that will be tied in between the four bamboo sticks that form the raft. These plants will then be dropped into the water. And what I found was interesting was that these were typically wives of fishermen, and because the seaweed raft can get pretty heavy, the men in the morning will help them drop the seaweed raft into the water and then take it out after a month's time.
Can you take a step back, though, and what does a little baby seaweed plant look like?
So this type of seaweed is called Capophycus alvarezi. It's reddish brown in color, and it feels sort of sticky but soft. It's a large leaf-like plant that, you know, it grows in water.
How long does it take for one of these baby plants to mature to harvest?
Right. So after the women have strung the pieces of a young plant in the bamboo raft, they then drop the raft into the water. And in about a month's time, it grows sixfold the amount. And that's when it's ready to be pulled out and harvested. Now, there's two things they can either do. They could sell it fresh as is, so that's the type of seaweed we eat, you know, or they could sell it dry. And that's really what the price point lies. It's about 30 times more value if you sell the seaweed dried. And all they have to do is take an extra step of drying it on the beach without letting it get sandy.
How sustainable is a farmed seaweed product compared to wild seaweed production, Shilpi?
Seaweed farming is surprisingly benign in the environmental side. In fact, a lot of the stakeholders we spoke with at Future 500 suggest that seaweed farming is actually good for the environment. Seaweed farms sequester a considerable amount of carbon because it can be absorbed. It is a natural filter, and it has been proven to reduce a significant amount of ocean acidification. Also, seaweed offers a food source for herbivorous fish. And it's known to clean the ocean areas around it, as since it acts as a natural filter.
So you mentioned how Pepsi-Cola had a desire to not only help a community in need, but also get a good, cheap source of carrageenan. Are there other companies that are following Pepsi's lead?
There are a number of cosmetics companies, so we're seeing a lot of seaweed and shampoos, face creams, moisturizers emerging. I just recently read an article about seaweed demand for beer. So they're popping out all over the place. The big ones that come to mind are FMC Biopolymer, Aveda, which is a popular cosmetics company. There are a number of health companies that use carrageenan in their organic foods as well, such as Silk.
Shilpi Chotre, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Habib Koite, Aretha Franklin, and Blind Faith. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.